From SDPB Radio, I'm Chris Loffrey, and you are listening to the In the Moment Arts Podcast. Leroy Parnell and Dan Mahar joined In the Moment host Lori Walsh on the heels of the Tallgrass guitar class in Laverne, Minnesota. The three-day class afforded like-minded musicians a chance to study under some of America's great guitar players. Leroy Parnell had several hit songs on the country music charts like What Kind of Fool Do You Think I Am?, On the Road, and Tender Moment. Guitarist Dan Mahar performs locally and also tours with country music artist Billy Dean. Parnell and Mahar shared several amazing stories from their time in the industry. Let's listen.
Welcome. Thank you for being here.
It sounds pretty impressive to hear you say it all at once, but it took a long time to do all
And it's
that.
A fraction. That's just a, you know, at some point you just have to stop writing the intro because you're like, we'll take 20 minutes just telling about all that you've done. And Dan, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
How did this weekend go, Dan, with everything happening at the Palace in Laverne? And you were on the show last week kind of giving a preview of the Tallgrass guitar class.
Well, it went, I had a little idea of how this should be, me and my buddy Scott and Dave, and it went just like I envisioned it, you know, and Leroy and Berlin and Pat, they did a great job on the concerts and the teaching. They were just stellar. I mean, those guys, and including me, I got to sit there and watch and listen.
Yeah.
I learned a thing or two. And
you know, when you go to some of those things, I'm sure it's just, there's so much, you know, inspiration and knowledge and content that you could spend a lifetime trying to implement it. So, what do you think when people come to a class or a lesson? How do they make the most out of it now that it's done? I mean, how do you continue that, integrating it into who you are as a musician?
You know, I try to keep what I have to say to these students concise and simple, because I don't think, you know, overloading them with a bunch of information is just, you might as well just be watching a video or something. When you make a human connection, try to look at who you're talking to, and everybody's different. So you just, you know, kind of instinctively, just like conversation, you might speak to one fella one way, but another one you might speak to another way. His needs are different. You can tell by what he's already playing. So the whole idea is for them to get something opened up inside them that really already exists. They just don't know it's there yet. And if you can just open that portal just a little bit, they will take that in turn. See, a good teacher just teaches you how to learn. Hmm. Not necessarily, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, I really think. And I enjoy it. I've gotten to do several of these things, and I think these guys are on to a winning thing here. The attitude, and everybody was just all in all the time, and if somebody wanted to do something, we did it. I mean, we just rolled with the flow, and I don't think there was no snags along the way. It was a fun 3 days. And
can you see that shift happening? Can you see that door opening sometimes?
Sure.
If you know what you're looking for,
sure.
You kind of see the light bulb come on.
I'll let Dan answer his way, but I think everybody that was, I could see light bulbs coming on.
Well, remember the other day when we were sitting with what was his name, Tom? Mm-hmm. Tom from
Michigan?
Yeah,
Tom. Oh, he really got that.
When you showed him that little thing with the,
oh my
where
gosh,
to,
yeah.
I could see the light come on. And, I mean, he just had a big smile on his face, and you could see, there it went.
Yeah.
He got
He went from, sounding like an injured cat to making melody.
Yeah, just like
and
that.
I'm in 30 minutes time.
Wow.
And it's totally doable. It's just, there's secrets. I had we didn't really have guitar teachers where I grew up. I mean, I grew up out in the boonies of West Texas on a ranch. And there were all the ranchers played instruments because that was a holdover from the old days. As a matter of fact, I mean, I could tell you, I could go on forever to tell you about this, but the ranchers all played fiddle or guitar because that was our entertainment. We were too far out to get television.
Right.
And radio was spotty unless it was nice and cloudy, you know.
Right.
So we had to kind of learn on our own, but we had, you know, we had people that worked on the ranch that, and they knew a thing or two, and I'd pick it up where I could, you know, but nothing like this. And to have those little tricks to make you sound better than you really are, that gives confidence, and confidence breeds all kinds of good things, you know.
Mm-hmm. So, Dan, we talked last week, and I want to dig into that a little deeper, if you would, today. But you learning how to play just by listening to, I mean, you didn't have that. You didn't have guitar teachers. You're learning in a way, so much has changed for the better as far as access. But what's lost by some of that? Can you look back at that time when you were learning the way that you did and say, I'm lucky that that's how I got my start? Or do you just feel like, man, if only YouTube had existed then? Tell us a little bit about that.
It's like I was explaining to somebody the other day. Of course, you can reach up and with your mouse and stop the YouTube and go back, you know, and hope that you can. But with a man like this or like Leroy here or any of the guys, Pat or Verlin, they can actually see the dampening that you have to do. You know, sometimes if the camera angles aren't right with the, I mean, it's been a help. But as far as I'm concerned, growing up in Chicago, when I got old enough to play in the taverns, I could go out and see guys actually doing it, playing these songs that I grew up listening to. And then so if I was hung on something, you know,
right,
I could see it done because there was 200 cabaret licenses in Chicago where I grew up. So there was nightclubs everywhere.
Yeah, and, it really was.
You know. So I got to go see these guys play, and there's there's a lot of fine guitar players in Chicago.
Yeah.
Really, of all stripes. But to answer your question, I don't regret it a minute. It's served me so well to be able to, you know, then I can just go on stage with fellas like this, and I don't have any music. And, of course, sometimes you make a mistake, but like Pat said, Pat Donahue said the other night in the concert, if you make a mistake, play it twice. They think you mean it.
I will say, Dan, it has this inherent, it's so natural for him to, you got to teach people to listen. You don't have to teach Dan to listen. He already listens. So just that's half the battle, really. I mean, most people, it's hard to learn when your mouth's open, you know. He just fell right in. I mean, I came up here without a soul with me, and that's rare. I usually have some either road manager or a guitar player / road manager wherever I go. But this time I decided to just go it alone, just come on up. And I wasn't alone at all. I had Dan. From the moment I got up, and I've known Dan. We got to know, when did we meet, actually?
Way back in 92 or 93 at Cedar City, Utah.
That's right, yeah. It was basketball?
Tore my leg up playing basketball. We were Billy Dean. It was us. It was Billy Dean and Sawyer Brown. You know, Mark Miller and those guys like to play basketball. So Billy asked me to play center, you know. I said, I'm a football player, Billy. He says, do you need to go to something?
No.
We're good?
Keep going.
he said, I just want you to fill that hole in the middle. Just stand in that lane. So I called my wife, and I said, well, we're going to play a little ball with Sawyer Brown tonight after the concert. And then she said, well, now remember, you're almost 40 years old. And I said, oh, don't worry. It's just a game. It's just for fun. And, of course, she said, I don't ever recall seeing you ever play a game like it was just for fun. Might start that way.
On the phone, she knows.
So I wanted to win, you know, as you should when you engage, you want to win.
Especially when you're playing Mark Miller.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because they'll throw it back on you, you know. So I tore my knee up, you know, and so I was on crutches the night of the concert. Leroy was in sound check, and I was sitting there because I wanted to hear him. I knew he was in my alley, in my wheelhouse, what I love.
Right.
So I hobbled up to the stage and I asked him if he'd do Statesboro Blues. I introduced myself first, and he tore into it, and I just sat back and go, oh, this is how it's supposed to be. So that's how we met.
How about that?
And what's happening in your career at that time? Because this is a significant time for you.
It was. It was the beginning of the glory years, you know. I sort of refer to them as that, although it's a bit of a blur, because it all happened at once. It almost seems like... You know, it's like coming up on your life and fast forward, you know. Well, looking back on it, you can sort of disassemble it a little bit. And I'm either plagued with or gifted with a great memory. And I can recall what it was like. I mean, we'd done Leno so many times that it was long. I remember the last time Jay was still on the air and I got to do the show. We played Sacramento the night before and then took the bus into L.A. I went to bed. I didn't think about it. And I woke up in the parking lot in Burbank of the Tonight Show, and my little curtain on my bunk swung back and Leno stuck his face in my bunk, and he's got a large face. And in a small area, it really appears large, you know. And he said, you're going to sleep all day or you want to ride in this silver cloud I got out here?
Of course.
So I put a cap on, so I'm waking up and riding in this car. And I said, okay, well, who's on the show tonight? You know, you get like that, you know, because it's like second nature. You've done it 4 or 5 times. And I was doing it before I ever got to the couch or a performance, I was sitting with the band because Branford Marsalis took a liking to me somehow or another. Found out, I don't know how it happened, but he did. Anyway, so you realize, and I asked him, I said, who's on the show today? And he said, just you and Duvall. And I said, Shelley? And he said, no, you idiot. Robert. I went, and you have to understand, Robert Duvall walks on water for
right.
me. I mean, Lonesome Dove,
Ghost McCree.
That's right. The only movie I have on my iPad is Lonesome Dove. And when I check in to a hotel, I put my iPad next to my bed. I got my headphones on right there because Lisa's usually with me, and I don't want to wake her up. She's a light sleeper. I put Lonesome Dove in my headphones. I never probably get through just the first song.
Yeah.
You know, the theme song, but it lulls me to sleep. So there I am in Duval, and there he is, and we're talking, and we're getting made up together, and it was crazy. Yeah.
Did he know you?
Yeah, he did. Mm-hmm. He is a fabulous, fabulous dancer. I don't know if you know this, but he married this Argentinian woman who's about, I don't know, 40 years younger than him. And she was a competitive dancer. And so at his, where he lives in Virginia, he lives in Northern Virginia. And he built on his barn, in the second level, is a dance hall. He's got the money to do it, I guess. And so they have parties on Saturday nights, and all the neighbors come, and they dance, and they have bands. I mean, he knows how to live.
Do they have the crystal ball?
I don't think they have the crystal ball. I don't think the Argentinians went for that, but I'm surprised.
I'm surprised.
Brazilians definitely would have.
So when you play that night, and you're playing for a nationwide audience, you're playing for a studio audience, and you're also really playing for someone that you admire too. All those different experiences that you had and that you've had on stage with, you know, some of the great country artists of our time, of all time, did you ever trip out a little bit? I mean, were there moments where it was just so unreal and you had to catch yourself, or do you just play through because that's what you do and you're one of those people?
It takes a while, I think, to adjust to that.
Yeah.
But, there was a couple of times when I felt that awestruck feeling that you would imagine you would get. Haggard was my favorite of all. And luckily, he was very kind. We were talking about that. I just got a text and I happened to be on stage with him when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame, and I was actually doing I was up for a Horizon Award that year. So anyway, I was awestruck with Haggard at first, but there was so much familiarity between us that we became, he was like an uncle to me. Mm. Cash was one that he could walk into a room full of people. I've been in those rooms when full of people, you don't even see him, but the whole room changes. He had that kind of charisma. Mm. A few did, but generally speaking, most people were just nice. I mean, really, Nashville has changed so much, and Dan and I were talking about it on the way here. We really kind of, I don't mean to sound negative about this, I'm just telling the truth. We saw the end of an era. I mean, I knew Chet, I knew Roger Miller, and all these people were, and we ate lunch together. I mean, it was open door policy. You'd go down the alleys of 16th and 17th Avenue, and you knew if Jimmy Bowen was in there producing a record, because there his car was. And if you had a song to pitch him, you pulled on in, and they didn't care, you know. But today, it's a lockdown. I don't even know what it is. I'm just glad that I got to experience what I got to experience for as long as I did at the time that I did. This is the good old days for somebody.
Right.
You know, but the experience that Dan and I had was very, very different than what they're experiencing today. Am I saying that right?
Yeah. We were. Go ahead, Lori.
They know that, don't you think? I mean, the artists coming up today know.
I hope they don't know that.
You hope they don't know that.
Cause I hope they.
They'll just stay in bed and not get.
Well, no, I hope
they.
I hope they find a way to to make music and feel good about being where they're at. You know, mm-hmm. I mean. I wouldn't want to go into a situation thinking, well, this is not going to be good at all. I got to do this. You know, they got to have your hope. You got to have a dream, and you don't want it crushed by what you might perceive as, you know,
right.
Things being not the way they used to be.
Yeah, something that they missed along the way.
Of course they did.
But they did, and we did. You know, there was a time when, you know, Minnie Pearl told me a story one time about when her and Hank – they were touring, and Minnie didn't. She didn't let the guys curse in the car. He said, "Now listen, you guys talk like a bunch of sailors," and everybody respected Minnie, you know.
Yeah.
And she said, "I'm gonna put the." And she made a cigar box. She took a cigar box and she cut a hole in the top of it, and it was the cussing box. So if you if you cussed, you had to put a dollar in it.
Uh-huh.
Well, it said Hank, they got lost. They were in some town. They couldn't find it. And he let one fly. And he took out a 10 and stuffed it down in there. And she said, "It's only a dollar." He said, "I ain't done yet."
You know, Leroy, that Lonesome Dove story you were telling,
mm-hmm.
That's the DVD we watched whenever we'd leave Nashville to go out west. It was our tradition.
I don't doubt it.
Billy and Ray, who was his road manager,
yes.
They called me and Kenny Lewis, that guy I told you about, it was a bass player, Gus and Woodrow, because that's how we would fight. We'd fuss all the time. I'm the one making sure this is going on, you know. So we have that in common, Lonesome Dove especially.
You know, it's interesting. I don't know if you were in earshot of this. I think you were, but Verlin Thompson was with us this weekend, and Verlin and I have known each other for many, many years, but Verlin was Guy Clark's handler, backup guitar player and handler, and let me tell you, that was a lot to handle. I mean, I could tell you about a trip to France, but I couldn't tell it on the air. Not all of it. Guy was just Guy. Mm-hmm. Guy Clark was next to Haggard, I would say the greatest songwriter I ever knew, ever had the opportunity of knowing. He had a craft, and he hated that word, but it was just unlike anything. But what I'm getting to is Verlin. We were laughing about the fact that we had never really had a chance to speak and really communicate because we were both always watching Guy, making sure something didn't go awry. You know, so you're kind of a little bit nervous. So we had such a good time catching up. But he told me, he said, after Guy died, he said, you know, I worried about, he said, I just figured I'd find him in the bed in a motel one morning and that'd be it. But as it turns out, it was long and it was lengthy and it was not fun. Mm-hmm. You know, the end for Guy was not fun. And he was all about fun. And believe me, he had plenty of it. At 74, it was high mileage, 74. We're talking 120 years, really, in dog years, you know. But he said he felt like Call, the character of Woodrow F. Call, which is Tommy Lee Jones' character in Lonesome Dove. Those of you who are just joining us, we're talking about Lonesome Dove. And he said he felt like Call trying to haul Gus back to Texas. Mm-hmm. He said the last 5 years was just like I had those two sticks with that, mm-hmm. you know, with yeah. that hide over it with a dead body on the back of it trying to get it back to Texas. And eventually, that's what we did. You know, we took Guy, and we halved him up. He was cremated, and half of his ashes went to Rockport, Texas, and were in the wake of the ocean, and the rest of him went to Santa Fe, because he loved Santa Fe. So at last, Verlin finally got a chance to...
integrity look like? What does truth look like in the music business and in your careers? Have you sort of wrestled with this idea of, you know, being who you are, not being influenced and turned into something that you're not? Is that something you think about?
In the beginning, when I went to Nashville, I got a call. I was writing. I've always written songs since I was a little kid. And I was living in Austin, and I was opening for a lot of people who would come through Houston or Austin or Fort Worth or Dallas. And so because of that, people, national touring acts based in Nashville or wherever, they would hear these songs. They go, who wrote that song? I said, well, I did. They go, really? Send it to me. So I started having cuts from where I was. And my cousin, Robert Earl Keen, had moved. He and Lyle Lovett, who was his roommate at Texas A&M, had moved to Nashville temporarily to get their songwriting, because it was open season on Rodney Crowell and Guy Clark, and here we go with that whole thing again. They had opened the door for Texas singer-songwriters, so everybody wanted more. Let's look at the next generation. So there was a little portal, and literally I felt the door shut behind me. You know, you could feel the puff of wind. It's like, I was the last Mohican here getting in this deal. It's over. And luckily, it stuck. But they did want to change everything about me. I met with literally every label in town, and they all offered me a deal. But they all had a, yeah, but. Along with that, and that was, yeah, but you got to wear a cowboy hat. Well, listen, I know what a cowboy's life is because I was my father's firstborn, and I had 3,000 acres to make sure that was done what the old man said was done. I had men under me that were twice my age. I knew, so, you know, like a cowboy hat is a tool. It's to keep the sun off. And by the way, when you're inside, you take it off, you know. So I was coming from a whole different place. Right. It wasn't for show for me. Nothing was. And the slide guitar, for instance, which they said, and that, you need to stop that. You know, don't know what that
it's
is.
Painful to hear.
It's never been done, so therefore we can't do it. And I said, well, no, thank you, no, thank you, no, thank you, no, thank you. And then Tim Dubois came along, and Clive Davis was opening up a branch of Arista in Nashville. And Tim Dubois was an Oklahoman who was a renegade himself, and he understood that there was a value in. He didn't know quite how we would do it, and neither did I. But together we muddled through it. And we made our mistakes. We got our butts kicked a lot. But because we stuck to our guns, and believe me, there were some songs that, there was one particular song, I won't tell you which one it was, it was a number one song, and I hated it so much that I, even the week, and I was out with Hank a whole year, and that's a whole nother story. But I was out in that, the week that it went number one, I refused to play it on stage because I didn't believe in the song. It sounded way too much like On the Road. It sounded too much like What Kind of Fool. It sounded too much like Tender Moment. All these songs that I already had, I said, why do this again? Let's keep moving, guys. You know, let's do this. So the fights were always there with radio programmers, and then, you know, we lost the what you have here. We used to have that on terrestrial radio in every market. Then suddenly this conglomerate thing started happening. They deregulated ownership of stations, so these big conglomerates started owning one, or it was two actually, right. And they got it down to where one guy in Seattle, Washington was programming all the stations in America. Well, look, I'm not an educated man, but hellfire, I know good and well that the guy in Seattle, Washington, doesn't even know what they eat in Lafayette, Louisiana, much less listen to, you know. So we lost that regional thing. And so the first really record that I had hit was The Rock. And now it only went to 36. I had that number 36. I hit I figured I was number 36 there for a while, you know. We couldn't get it passed. But The Rock was a regional hit from Dallas to Raleigh, and everything, but we had it. I mean, it was, you know, we were playing it every hour.
Yeah.
But we couldn't get the Northeast to play it. The Midwest wouldn't play it. The West Coast wouldn't play it. But it was a sacrificial lamb because they admitted, they said, we missed this one.
Yeah.
We won't let you down again. And they didn't. And the song that you just played it came out the winner because poor old The Rock had, you know, it had really done its job. But you understand.
Tell me about the blues and the connection between and sort of the latest album and how you don't really necessarily separate, you know, singer, mm-hmm. songwriter, guitarist, blues, country, you know, whatever. Does that have any meaning to you? It's all coming from one place for you.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that.
That's astute of you to mention it. Thank you for doing it. Because what people need to realize, and right now they can turn on, you can go join PBS, and if you're not already on PBS, you need to be. Best programming we got in the country. But Ken Burns has got a thing on country music, and it will educate you to everything I've been preaching for years. Country and blues in their true form, okay, in their actual true form, are really brother and sister. They have the same mom and daddy. And, it, you know, it's like Muddy Waters said, the blues had a baby and they called it rock and roll. It all, this is our American music. This is our American experience. It's the hillbilly music that came out of the mountains. That's all Scotch-Irish music, fiddles, that whole thing. The banjo was an African instrument. And then you got the all the folks in the Delta who had brought all that music from Africa over. And when those met, and then you get over to Texas, where I'm from, then you got the Mexican influence and all that comes in, and the German influence and all that comes in. And it is a, just one big old melting pot. So everybody, I don't know why everybody was so afraid to, you know, they didn't understand that blues and country were, but I could show them. I said, look, I'll prove it to you right now. And I'd play Trouble in Mind, or I'd play something like we did Milk Cow Blues last night. And it's been done by everybody from Jimmy Rogers to Led Zeppelin. So give me a break, you know, if that, you know, it's all the same thing and it's true form. Now, as things have become more compartmentalized and I don't know who did that. They ought to be flogged for doing it. But I think, you remember when radio in the 60s, we just had radio. I mean, you might hear a Perry Como record right next to a Beatles record. I mean, it was nobody thought anything about that. And those days, that was when I was very impressionable. And a young lad growing up, I was born in 56. So in the 60s, I was listening to all this on the radio. I was glued to the radio. So everything I heard, I was like a sponge, you know. And home, it was Bob Wills, Sam Cooke, and Louis Armstrong. That was it. So that was where, you know, and that there again, all three of those artists were people who mixed musics. Sam came from a gospel background, the Soul Stirrers, and Bob Wills was all about the blues, all about the blues, although they associated him with Western Swing. And Louis Armstrong was the grandpappy of all of what we do, in my estimation.
We're going to play a little musical cut from the latest CD. This is called Midnight Believer, the title track. Of Midnight Believer there, Leroy Parnell and Dan Mahar in the studio with us. Let's just do this all day. What are you excited for next? What are the, I mean, this, there's a gap of, you know, time sort of slipped away between releases of albums. You've talked about that publicly, of, you know, parenting and some of just life. And
it took a little longer than expected. It actually just kind of crept up on me when that... When I went, let's see, I went from Arista, and when they virtually just, Arista dropped all the French acts. Anybody who was Sleep at the Wheel got dropped, the Tractors, BR549, myself, I think Pam got dropped too. I went immediately, I had a brand new batch of songs. I was getting ready to make another album. I got on a jet and went out to L.A., and I made a deal with the Welk people because I had been writing for Polygram, and they owned that catalog. And I made a deal that day with Larry Welk, and it was a handshake deal to this day. And we went to Vanguard Records. He owned Vanguard. He owned Sugar Hill. And so I went, I thought, this is my freedom here. This is my freedom. And that record still is one of my favorite albums I ever did. Then from there, I went to Universal South, and we made that record. And then that long period of time when my little boy was born. Because I have two children, older children, that are 38 and 34. And my granddaughter's from my daughter, who's 34. And so I was busy with that. But then little Jack came, you know, he was a surprise. Yeah. And but it changed. I just shut it down. You know, I played enough to keep food on the table and the lights on. But really, it was my opportunity to do for him what I wasn't able to do for my my older children. And so I'm now at a crossroads where I've got two albums slated for next year. Not one, but two. And they're both going to surprise you.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. What are you excited for, Dan?
Pardon me?
Tell me what you have up next. What's coming up for you?
Oh, well, I can't remember right now, Laura. My head's been buried in this bucket of getting this thing.
That's not really a fair question after this weekend with Tallgrass. Yeah,
I mean, I'm looking forward to, you know. Yeah, it was good to reestablish friendships with these guys, and you know, and hopefully we'll meet up again somewhere. I'm looking forward to just trying to keep playing music and getting better.
Yeah.
And I have no nothing on the horizon musically. Just do what I do, and
that's what it's all about. Keep playing music and keep getting better. Yeah. And keep playing together.
And I'm happy that it is that way. I've got my life and a career, not just a career.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the door is open here. I look forward to those. Look forward to 2020 to see what comes from Leroy Parnell. I'm sure we'll be talking about it.
I look forward to coming back. If you get a chance to see Dan, don't miss it, because he's got a beautiful voice. He plays incredibly. I mean, it's better, way better time than I've got. I can tell you that. And it's just go see him. And I hope that this Tallgrass thing happens again next year, because I think it's a winner. I just think, you know, it takes a little ramp up time, and it takes patience, and you learn with everyone you do. But everybody has been so kind and nice, and we've had. We just had a great time. We're all a little bleary because it was 3 days and we didn't stop moving. I don't think just to sleep. Yeah. But it was a great experience. Nice folks up here.
This week is Women's Entrepreneurship Week, and the Zeal Center for Entrepreneurship is hosting a special edition of 1 Million Cups. The weekly entrepreneurship event highlights local business owners and provides an opportunity to network with like-minded people. Joining Lori were Brian Maynor, Executive Director of Zeal, Amanda Christofferson, owner of Boutique in Brandon, and Karina Glover of her headquarters.
All right, Brian, let's start with you, because this is a pretty exciting event. Tell us how you put this together.
You bet. So we caught wind of the fact that this is Women's Entrepreneurship Week because our friends up in Fargo, North Dakota are putting on quite a display this week. Mm-hmm. And so that excitement has trickled down here to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and we just wanted to shine a spotlight on all of our female founders. And the best way that we can do that is with our weekly entrepreneurship event, which is 1 Million Cups, which happens every Wednesday at 9 a.m. in downtown Sioux Falls. Hills. And to back up a minute, the Women's Entrepreneurship Week is a movement that is now celebrated in over 160 universities, ranging from 46 states and 32 countries. And it's designated to highlight females who have been founders and leaders in different companies and raise awareness for these historically underrepresented women. So it's very important that we put this on the map here in Sioux Falls.
Now, as she says that in such a really concise and powerful way, Amanda, are you thinking, that's me?
You're right.
Hello, here we are. Wait a minute, me, founder, because you kind of started your business in your basement.
In my basement, yeah.
And were you thinking, I am this, you know, high-level entrepreneur, founder?
not at all. I'm like, I'll just get some clothes and see what happens. And yeah, here, I don't know how, yeah, now we're a 10,000 square foot warehouse, and I'm like, how did this happen? But
right. I think a lot of women can relate to that, though, and that's probably one of the things you're hoping for, Fran.
Absolutely.
You know, when people get together and say that, tell me, take me to the unfinished basement.
Right.
And the idea that, hey, I'm going to have some people over to try on some clothes.
Right.
How did you get started?
Well, so I always wanted to own my own business. I just really wasn't sure what it was going to be. My husband and I adopted a baby, and I figured this would have been our third child. And I'm like, I never had the opportunity to stay home with my first two, and I really wanted to try to stay home with our newly adopted newborn, Micah. And so I'm like, I am going to start an online boutique, and I'm just going to do it out of my house. I'm going to be able to spend time with him every day and stay home with him. And somehow it ended up a couple months later opening up a storefront and never being home. But I mean, it's like, the ball started rolling, and I didn't want it to stop, and I just kept going with it. And somehow it all worked out great, and keep on praying that it keeps going that way. But yeah, it's just kind of it's crazy how it happened. It just happened.
Because you were able to listen to your customers, and you found
And
people wanted, they wanted that storefront.
Right.
They wanted that kind of boutique,
experience. Exactly. And that customer experience, I feel like, is what really makes us stand apart from others, is that we care. I literally will lose sleep if someone is not happy. Like, it's just, I just want people to be happy, and if giving them a new outfit is what's going to make them smile, then great. Let me help. So, yeah.
Let's bring Karina into the conversation. Tell us about her headquarters, because this is a pretty high-tech thing that's happening here that connects people like Amanda with other entrepreneurs across the country. Tell us what her headquarters is, Karina.
Yeah, it's funny hearing Amanda talk, because I feel like we have the same values, and we started off going one way and ended up with something different, but something even better. But her headquarters is a newly launched app, actually launched in May of this year in 4 cities. And what the app does is connect women entrepreneurs to brand partnership opportunities on a national scale with other women-owned businesses. You know, in my journey, I came across a lot of women who own businesses and, you know, the fashion industry, beauty, entertainment, events, and PR. And I found that they wanted to partner with other companies to increase their revenue, to increase their exposure and customer. But they had, you know, the process of securing those partnerships is really time consuming. So what our app does is connect them with other women who are intentional about collaborating, rather they're small business to small business, or small business to big business partnerships, and it gives them access to women-owned brands to collaborate with them for upcoming projects, events, and campaigns.
Give me an example of how this might work.
Yeah, so I'll give you an actual real example. We have a user named Caressa who joined the app pretty early on, and Caressa actually owns a fashion line. And so at the time that Caressa joined her headquarters, her company was only about 4 months old, and she happened to kind of blow up pretty quickly, and she had an opportunity to headline Fashion Week in her city, which is a pretty big deal for a brand new company of that size. And so she and I were talking, and she goes, well, I really want to maximize this moment. And instead of making, you know, instead of giving our company the spotlight that one night during Fashion Week, I really want to create a campaign centered around my company and really start a conversation about fashion for tall women, because her line created custom clothing for women over 5'10". So she used her headquarters to post a collaboration opportunity. So the opportunity that she had was for a paid partnership between her fashion line and a PR agency that specializes in fashion. So she posted the collaboration opportunity, and she really gave the specifics of what the opportunity is, the time frame of the partnership, what she was offering the owner of that company she wanted to partner with, and within 24 hours, she was able to secure a partnership with the owner of a fashion PR company. And wow. So they did an eight-week campaign, which brought more attention to her brand on a national scale beyond her city. So that's an example of, you know, two business owners with two different companies coming together to execute something that makes it beneficial for both of them.
Wow. Brand, you hear stories like this, you have to get excited about the connection possibilities.
Absolutely. This is the most important thing we can do to help support entrepreneurs, and especially women entrepreneurs here in Sioux Falls. We have to share these stories, and we have to connect those that are, you know, kind of teetering on the idea of starting a business, and they're just not quite there with their confidence level, or they feel like they don't have the support, to connect them with people like Karina and Amanda, who are killing it. Yeah. Out there, you know, and just showing that this is possible. And it's almost the ultimate form of women's empowerment, to take your life into your own hands and create your own journey. I just, exactly. I think it's so inspiring.
Well, and Amanda, how many employees do you have? So the ripple, let's talk a little bit about how this resonates, not just in your own life, which it clearly has,
right.
But this family that you work with now.
Yeah. And when you say family, I live and breathe and just love my employees so much. I wouldn't be able to do what I do without them. I think we are just right under 20 employees. I believe we have 10 full-time, and then the rest are part-time at the store. I can't even explain how much they mean to me.
Yeah. From a consumer standpoint, from the women who are listening, who are like, you know, I don't necessarily want to start my own business, but I'm awfully excited about boutique, or I'm awfully excited about somebody like Amanda who's putting all this thought. Now I can just go and have a nice time and pick, you know, like this is all laid out for me, which is way different than going to. I don't want to pick on anybody,
right,
but, you know,
right.
A big box, that, you know, where it's not
it's
sort
different.
Of locally sourced and sort of locally thought out.
Exactly.
There's a huge opportunity, Brand, too, for who's served by this. And you mentioned underrepresented as far as women in business and you know, women starting their own business. It makes a difference to women who aren't in business at all based on their consumer experience.
Absolutely.
As well.
And women are the ones that hold the pocketbook a lot of the time. And we're the ones that are making the decisions. Yep. So it's really important that your focus on customer service is absolutely spot on. We want an experience. Yeah. So you've done your research.
Yeah. And I feel like that's kind of like fashion isn't really even my thing. You'll see me in sweatpants and leggings more than you'll actually see me in jeans.
Amen.
But I feel like the customer experience and the customer service is what we started strong in. And the fact that we actually care, and you're going to get a different experience with us than if you walk into a big box store.
And I will pick on big box a little bit because they're following suit. It's really interesting to see. I come from the world of downtown Sioux Falls, and the retailers in downtown Sioux Falls have some sort of special sauce, because you're starting to see it spill over into the big box where they even talk about having that downtown urban feel. Right. If you've noticed, the Target stores here in Sioux Falls have kind of remodeled, and you can feel it feels like more of a boutique setting.
Right.
So I think it's really interesting that, you know, our entrepreneurs are the ones that are driving the conversation, and it's really exciting to see.
Yeah. Karina, you can't see this because it's radio, but she's got a pretty cool sweatshirt on, and Brand's wearing this fierce yellow blazer.
Yeah, so. I should probably wear jeans today.
I actually kind of want to know if you sell that sweatshirt. Because
I do.
It's
cool.
And so my sweatpants and sweatshirt is life for me, too.
Perfect.
Yes.
I want to just, Amanda, before we let you go, this idea of, and you as well, Karina, very briefly, this idea of believe, you know, you both started out somewhere and you ended up somewhere else. And that means there was a turn lane that you had to give yourself permission to walk down. What gave you, Amanda, let's start with you, sort of that moment, or, you know, those million moments, as it might be, where you said, I can do this. This isn't what I started out with, but I'm going to say yes to what's next.
Right. I think what has drove me to keep going is the fact that, and not a lot of people know this, but I had my first baby when I was 16, and I did not want to be another statistic. I wanted to provide more for my family than what a lot of people believed I could. And I think that's been my driving force, is to show my kids, we started here, but we can go somewhere else with our lives. You don't have to, you know, I grew up this way, so I have to follow that path. It's you make your own path and just keep going. And Just keep believing.
Karina, in 30 seconds, where does that confidence come from for you?
For me, it really comes from knowing that it's bigger than me. You know, with my background in event planning, I felt like it was about me and it was about my client. But with her headquarters, literally it's about all the women across the world who own businesses, who deserve to take their business to new heights, and who deserve partnerships and allies. And so I think when I realized that it was okay for me to switch lanes, and then also knowing that me switching lanes allowed me to impact more women, it was a green light, and that's what fueled my confidence and pushed me to keep going and not feel bad about the unexpected change in career. Mm.
Karina Glover, the app is Her Headquarters, Amanda Christofferson. It's boutique in brand and website online, Amanda?
Yep, www.shop-boutique.com.
And 1 Million Cups is Wednesday at 9 with these two powerful women for Women Entrepreneurship Week.
And if you're looking for more events and networking opportunities, visit realzeal.com. We've got a whole list of events.
The Lakota Music Project has returned from their residency in Washington, D.C., where they performed at the Washington National Cathedral and the Smithsonian Museum of the American Indian. The trip marks the first time the Lakota Music Project has performed outside of South Dakota. Support for the musicians was evident in the send-off concert held on October 15th at the Visual Arts Center of the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls, when supporters flooded the space to hear the performance and celebrate the musicians. Maestro Delta David Geyer returned to In the Moment with a recap of the trip and the national media response. Mr. Geyer, welcome back.
Thanks.
And we'll get to the send-off concert here in a few minutes, and that was wildly successful.
Yeah.
But take us back to the inception of this project, if you will, and just kind of give us an idea how it formed and then ultimately how it came together.
Well, it goes back actually almost 15 years, my first season with the orchestra, and just the conviction that that a symphony orchestra should serve its unique community uniquely, mm-hmm. to see who the people are in your community that with whom you can partner, and also looking for issues to address. And you know, a lot of orchestras do concerts like Martin Luther King Day, mm-hmm. that sort of thing, and then we'll have African American artists and that sort of thing. But it became pretty evident early on that while that's obviously a good thing to do, that the more pertinent collaboration would be with Lakota and Dakota musicians. Mm-hmm. So we held a luncheon at the end of my first season. This would have been spring of 2005. And it was a luncheon for Lakota leaders here in Sioux Falls. Mm-hmm. And it was very informative for me. I was met with pretty much total distrust about what I wanted to do, which and it was my first lesson on, even though I had lots of ideas and things, that really what I needed to do was listen. And there was one person, Barry LeBeau, that came out of that luncheon who said, you know, you're a little crazy, but I'd like to try to help you. And so Barry basically shepherded me around the state for a couple of years, off and on, introducing me to cultural leaders and tribal elders and people that helped us create what is now the Lakota Music Project, which has been, the first tour of the project was a little over 10 years ago. And now we've played this project somewhere between 40 and 50 times.
Wow.
Six of the nine reservations, and in several different cities. We played it in Pierre during legislative session. A lot of different venues, a lot of different people, and the idea is that we can collaborate through music in such a way that we can demonstrate how we can share our cultures, how we can learn how to respect each other and build friendship, mm-hmm. which is actually what's happening now. It's like like Brian Akipa, a cedar flute player from Sisseton, and Emmanuel Black Bear, keeper of the drum for the Creekside Singers from Pine Ridge. I mean, these are people we've worked with now for the whole time, and they are friends. We are friends. And that's quite evident when we are in front of an audience making music together. And there are many others besides those as well. But, you know, it's a kind of relationship that is quite unique. And it's evident to pretty much anybody who experiences it. Even, you know, taking it to D.C., you know, I mean, you get on the East Coast and, you know, and that's where I'm from. So, you know, they hear everything, you know. So, but this project is very special. It's not just another world music concert. It's not just another, you know, orchestra backing up an ethnic musician or something. This is real collaboration, an intertwining of the two cultures.
Interesting. Let's go back 10 days to the send-off concert. Now, I talked to a few members of your staff, and I think nobody really expected the turnout that you got, and it was unbelievable. What kind of visible support, all right? What did that mean for the musicians ahead of this journey they were about to go on?
Well, I mean, it's very exciting. Mm-hmm. It's always exciting to play for a large and engaged crowd, but we thought of this as a rather intimate event, you know, for people who were just interested in this particular project. So we planned for maybe 100 people or so, and we had well over 200. It was in the art gallery, so it was spilling over all over the place. So, and we had, you know, hold the concert so we could, you know, set up more chairs and all of that. It's very exciting to the support, the interest, the engagement, the support was palpable.
Mm-hmm. What kind of once it was complete and all those people, did they hang around? What were you hearing from the people?
Well, for those who'd never heard it before, it was the usual response. We'd never heard anything like this. I mean, you hear those words, Lakota Music Project, and you think, well, what does that sound like? Mm-hmm. You know, and it's truly a unique sound when you, interweave a Dakota cedar flute into a group of classical musicians or a Lakota singer singing, you know, above an entire group of classical musicians playing. It's quite a unique thing. But then the people who have been following it, the people who have supported it, it's just a real sense of pride in the orchestra, in the Lakota Music Project in particular, and the opportunity for us to basically be ambassadors for the state of South Dakota in Washington, D.C., in a non-political way, you know, to go take something that's of palpable value to these audiences. And we played five different programs in D.C., and every single one of them was received, in such a positive way. So, it's a meaningful experience for everyone.
My next thought is really twofold. 15 years in the making, this is the first time this project has left the borders of South Dakota. Mm-hmm. It took that long for what reason do you think? I mean, you think you could have done that almost 5-10 years into it? But you've chosen now.
It's all financing. All of it. Yeah. Honestly, I mean, I mentioned this during our send-off concert. Mm-hmm. You know, we've been doing this for 10 years now, but there have been entire years where we've had no Lakota Music Project activity because we've been going from grant to grant to grant to grant. You know, when you get a grant, you play. When you don't get a grant, you don't play. So there's a lot of work on the part of our board now to try and help this to be more sustainable from a financial perspective so that we can be more consistent, have a more consistent presence on the reservations. You know, we have these composition academies for Lakota and Dakota high schoolers now, and we've done that for 3 years in a row, and it's such an impactful program. And anybody who's ever heard what these young people come up with and how our musicians play their music and interact with them, it's such an impactful thing. That, you know, when you think about something like that going away, it's no, that cannot go away. Mm-hmm. So it's always this challenge of trying to gain support and you know, the South Dakota Symphony is not going to go to D.C. or any other major metropolitan area and play Beethoven. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's plenty of Beethoven happening at the Kennedy Center, at Lincoln Center and all of that. But there's nothing like the Lakota Music Project in any of these places. So this is something that that we have, you know, really can be very proud of and can take out and tour. I mean, we're still waiting to make a recording. There's no recording of any of this music that we've done. We have several pieces that we've commissioned, you know, for our Lakota Dakota partners to play with us and like in this intertwined way and everything. But it's been an elusive thing to try to get the funding to actually make a recording. We have offers from a major new music label and all of that. So we're still trying to get that done. Hopefully this DC trip will help with that. So we have something to put in people's hands, mm-hmm. you know? So, you know, this is the Lakota Music Project. Right now we have nothing.
While in D.C., did you find that the audience members that were attending, had they heard of this project and the work you've been doing with them, or was it fresh for many people?
Well, a lot of people came specifically to hear the project because there had been quite a bit of press, a preview article from in the Washington Post going back to the beginning of September. And several follow-up things. So there had been, and the Museum of the American Indian really promoted it a lot too. Like that concert we gave on Saturday afternoon was jam-packed. Mm-hmm. I mean, the main floor was packed, and there were people like hanging over all the different levels of balcony and everything. So that was just a huge, huge success.
At the beginning, you mentioned the press. What kind of national media response did you receive for this?
Well, several articles by Washington-based papers. A lot of attention here in Sioux Falls around this project, which we're thankful for. I mean, even though the project's been going for 10 years, this is the first time that because we were taken outside the state, then people really paid a lot of attention to it. So that was great, there are reviews being written as we speak of the different programs that we did. So we're thankful for the attention.
If you're just joining us, our guest today is Maestro Delta David Garr with the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra. You mentioned Brian Akipa earlier. He's a Dakota Cedar flutist, like you said, and a National Endowment for the Arts National Treasure. Now, how challenging is it to combine his traditional music with the classical music tradition of the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra, and how do you make it work?
Well, it's truly a collaboration. So, you know, we're it's the give and take happens on both sides of the equation. So, you know, we have music that's written down that we read music off of a page, and all the indications are there. And there's none of that in Lakota or Dakota tradition, so it's not written down, and there's a flexibility. Like you have a lead singer at the drum, basically that person, you know, begins the song at whatever pitch they want to, what they find, and then everybody else follows. So that's a challenge immediately for people who are reading off of a page, because what pitch do we even start on? And then do we transpose the entire piece, you know, that sort of thing. So, also in terms of tempo, that's somewhat flexible as well. The drum of course is a steady beat, but both pitch and tempo are variable, with emotion. Like if it's a sad song, then the pitch can actually, you know, sort of travel downwards during the course of a song, and the tempo can also become more flexible. Conversely, if it's a really exciting, I tease Emmanuel Blackbear, it's like, so you're at a powwow and you're in the final round and there's $25,000 on the line. Does the pitch get higher? Does the tempo get faster? Answer would be yes. So we've, a good example is this piece that there's a song that Emmanuel wrote for his mother. It's a very emotional thing for him. kind of sad. And our former composer in residence, a native composer, Jared Tate, had written an orchestral accompaniment for him. And it really depends on his mood, mm-hmm. where he places that in terms of pitch. So the initial rehearsals, like our string quartet, were actually adjusting pitch wise as he was singing. And it's kudos to our musicians that mm-hmm. they're willing to do that, that they're believe so much in the project and they have so much love for Emmanuel that, you know, so let's just do this. Let's figure this out. And in the end, you know, the composer, the native composer, Jared Tate, he actually challenged him. He said, listen, Bull, that's Emmanuel's nickname. He said, Bull, mm-hmm. you know, you're going to have to stick with the same pitch, you know? And so, we ended up going back to a fixed pitch and Jeff Paul, our oboist, sat down next to him and played along with him to help him with that, staying on that pitch. So he actually had to adjust the way that he would normally sing the song in order to sing it with us. So you see what I mean? The give and take mm-hmm. goes both ways. And we don't mind doing that. It's not like either one of us has deficiencies or just doesn't understand what the other one's doing. But we through the course of working together and rehearsing together, we do come to understand one another, and we make these adjustments as necessary.
Have you had a chance to debrief with the musicians and how their journey went and what their thoughts of it were?
With the quartet, yes, because one of the main reasons we were invited to go to DC was to take part in a larger festival that was put together by Joseph Horowitz, who's a leading musicologist in the country, but he curates a series at the National Cathedral called the Post Classical Ensemble. And he wanted the Lakota Music Project to have more of a national attention, mission accomplished, mm-hmm. Because he's been here and he loves our orchestra and he understands what we're about and he really wants us to be able to get this out and about. But he also is, some of his scholarship is earlier American music, and this particular festival was around Indianists, mm-hmm. which are, composers, white composers a century ago that were inspired by Native American culture. And yeah, some of it's kitsch, but some of it is not. Some of it is actually just intended to be totally reverential and really seeking to honor that culture. So there's our quartet for the last 2 days has been in the studio recording a quartet written by Arthur Farwell, who's the leading Indianist composer. Mm-hmm. And they played it out in D.C. On Monday night at the National Cathedral. So, but this will be the world premiere recording of that piece. And it'll go on a major label along with other pieces of Arthur Farwell that were presented while we were in D.C.
In our remaining minute, what's next for the Lakota Music Project?
The release of this CD. Mm-hmm. We talked a lot about planning and things that we would like to do, but then we're back to the funding thing. So it's a question mark at this point as to when it will hit the road again. It's basically, you know, when we get the funding, we go.
Maestro Delta David Geyer, the congratulations to you and your staff and all the musicians, and what a wonderful project, and I'm glad it all came together, and what a fabulous thing you guys have done.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's been an honor to be involved with this, and we just keep plugging forward.
Much appreciated. Thanks for being here. It wouldn't be an arts podcast without poetry from Studio 47. Let's hear what Patrick Hicks has for us this week.
This is poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is Todd Boss. He was born on December 6th, 1968, in Marshfield, Wisconsin. He grew up on a cattle farm and then attended St. Olaf College, where he received his BA. From there, he went to the University of Alaska, Anchorage, where he earned his MFA in creative writing. His books include Yellow Rocket, Pitch, and Tough Luck. Boss has won the Emily Clark Belch Prize, the Midwest Booksellers Choice Award, and he has received grants and fellowships from the Minnesota State Arts Board, as well as the McKnight Foundation. Not only has he taught at the Loft Literary Center in Minneapolis, but he is also the founder of Motion Poems, which is a film company that has created over 100 adaptations of poems. Boss has worked hard to bring poetry into the daily lives of those around him. Today's poem is The Mind Will Wander. I've long admired the work that Todd Boss creates. His work is always carefully crafted, and each line, each word, resonates with musicality. While this is generally true of most poems, Boss's work has crisp internal rhymes, and it's clear that he pays very close attention to sound. You'll hear exactly what I mean in a minute. Our poem for today is about the looping route that our imaginations can take when we're supposed to be thinking of something else. I like how this poem mimics wandering thought, how we move through the syrup of daydreaming before returning to where we started. This is The Mind Will Wander by Todd Boss. The mind will wander as water will seep, as mice will yonder, creep the clover deep and still knows home, as a wren will dither daily in the dome and remember the nest's address, as honeybees comb September for nectar. So the mind will wander between the lines of music or news or conversation, will spend attention on wonder's fine wines, will even tend towards understanding, and, swollen with booty or duty or beauty, survive to wend away back to the studious hive and the subject at hand.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. All poems used with permission, recorded at Augustana University and produced by Peter Folliard. Thank you for listening.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Looking for an individual segment from our radio program? You can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org and on our daily podcast, In the Moment Segments. The In the Moment podcast is produced by Josh Heyer. Follow Lori on Twitter at @MomentSDPB. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Josh Heyer, Lori Walsh, and Steve Zwemke, I'm Chris Lawfrey. Thanks for listening.